The headlines: U.S. President Donald Trump pardons four Blackwater contractors who were given lengthy prison terms for massacring Iraqi civilians in 2007. Iran's president says the U.S. has failed to achieve its goals of bringing down the Islamic Republic through sanctions. And Germany registers a new record of daily coronavirus fatalities as Europe is threatened with a new variant of the virus identified in the UK. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: U.S. President Donald Trump has pardoned four security guards from a private military firm who were convicted of killing 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. Trump granted full clemency to the former Blackwater contractors who were serving lengthy prison sentences. They had been convicted on charges of opening fire on unarmed people and voluntary manslaughter in Iraq. At the sentencing, the U.S. Attorney's Office said the guards' actions resulted in a sheer amount of unnecessary human loss. The group's massacre of Iraqi civilians also set off an international uproar over the rise of private contractors in war zones. However, the guards' supporters argue that they have been excessively punished. Trump has already granted presidential pardons to other officials and military personnel during his final days in office. Iran's president says his American counterpart has failed to achieve his goals through an economic war waged against the Islamic Republic. Hassan Rouhani called U.S. President Donald Trump a crazy man who sought to topple the Islamic establishment in Iran. Rouhani said Iranian nation ousted Trump with its resistance. He also said Trump was isolated even by U.S. traditional allies in Europe over his policy on Iran. The outgoing American president imposed tough sanctions on Tehran after walking out of a multilateral nuclear deal in 2018, President-elect Joe Biden has promised to rejoin the deal and seek diplomacy with Iran. Foreign policy analyst Paulina Anifdu says Trump's policy of sanctions against Tehran failed because the West does not have a good understanding of Iran.
The United States, they're isolated about their foreign policy in Middle East, and the Middle East foreign policy of the United States is the main axis of their policy. It is the main pillar of their foreign policy. But what we need to understand in this case is that the West doesn't have a very good understanding of Iran. What the United States, they tried to do with the assistance, of course, of Israel and some European powers, is that they believe that if they go along with the sanctions to Iran, Iran is going to collapse. We're going to have a change of government and a regimental change. What they don't understand is that Iran is a very self-sufficient economy, so in the case of a war, Iranians are going to have water, is going to have food, they are going to have milk, something that does not exist into the Western economies.
The U.S. has imposed new sanctions on Syria, targeting its central bank and several other entities. Key advisors of President Bashar al-Assad, as well as his wife, are among those blacklisted. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on Assad and his wife Asma in June. Washington accuses Asma of using her charities and civil society organizations to consolidate Damascus's political and economic power. The U.S. has so far imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Syrian government, accusing it of cracking down on its people. Damascus has dismissed the accusation. It says U.S. measures target ordinary Syrians and hamper an ongoing reconstruction process following years of conflict. Activist and commentator Mimi Al-Lahm believes the U.S. policy on Syria will remain unchanged regardless of who heads the White House.
I think that the U.S. essentially is indicating that it's, you know, whoever the new administration is, or since they're moving from the Trump administration to a Biden administration, that they're continuing their efforts in Syria regardless. And when I say efforts, I mean their plan to destroy Syria. Since they can't put military pressure on Assad, other than occupying the northeast of the country and controlling the oil resources, they're placing sanctions. So essentially what they're trying to do is starve Syrians into submission. And what they want is for Syria to agree to a constitution that would create a Kurdistan and allow the U.S. to remain inside Syria permanently. And Syria is never going to do that. So unfortunately, this means that it's an indication that the U.S. is not ready to pull out of Syria, and they're going to have to do something to force them to pull out of Syria.
The UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution urging Israel to halt demolishing and confiscating Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. The resolution, among other things, urged Israel to cease destroying civilian and vital infrastructure in the occupied territories. The General Assembly adopted the measure following a report by one of its committees on the situation in those territories. Rights groups say a large number of Palestinians have been displaced this year as a result of continued Israeli demolitions. The regime says it destroys the structures that lack construction permits. Palestinians reject this. They say the demolitions are aimed at expanding Israeli settlements that are illegal under international law. Tunisia says it's not interested in establishing diplomatic relations with Israel following reports that it may normalize ties with Tel Aviv. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry said the country's position will not be affected by international developments. The remarks follow reports by U.S. media saying Tunisia might be the next Arab nation to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Morocco was the latest Arab state to sign U.S. brokered deals with Israel after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. On Tuesday, an Israeli envoy arrived in Rabat to meet the Moroccan king in the first direct flight between Israel and Morocco. Palestinians have strongly slammed normalization deals with Israel as a stab in their back and a betrayal of their cause. Pakistan has resisted calls by the United Arab Emirates to establish diplomatic ties with Israel. Earlier, we were joined by our guests in the News Review program to discuss the issue. Let's take a listen.
Pakistan says anti-Israeli sentiments inside the country and similarities between Palestinian and Kashmiri disputes provide sufficient grounds to reject UAE efforts to normalize Islamabad's ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Pakistan's clear stance on this issue has come after its foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi. Press TV correspondent Javed Rana has your details out of Islamabad.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel. Something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And joining us now for this news review is Zafar Bangesh, Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us from Toronto, and Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, also joining us from Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with Mr. Bangesh there. Zafar, my first question to you, welcome to the program. Let me get that out the way. And my first question, tell us if you can how you interpret the narrative there, what's going on in the minds of the those in charge in Islamabad.
Well, as far as the decision makers in Islamabad are concerned, they of course do feel the pressure both from the United Arab Emirates as well as Saudi Arabia that is pulling the strings from behind the scenes. They want Pakistan to establish diplomatic relations with the Zionist regime. But as your correspondent from Islamabad pointed out, Pakistan cannot do so, despite the fact that it is facing enormous economic problems, and its workers both in Saudi Arabia and the UAE might be expelled, which would be a big economic blow to Pakistan. But politically, Pakistan cannot do so because Pakistan sees the occupation of Palestine and the occupation of Kashmir as identical issues. And Pakistan has made absolutely clear that as long as the Palestinian question has not been resolved, it will not recognize Israel.
Thank you, Zafar. And Edward, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, Edward, I mean, in all the deals that we've seen recently, the last few countries that have decided to normalize ties with the Israeli regime, we've seen huge amounts of debt relief. We've seen a unilateral recognition of, desert territory. We've seen very lucrative weapons contracts. My question to you, why such pressure and incentives? I mean, how come no one just decided, hey, you know, we want to be friends with these great guys in Tel Aviv? Why did it take so much to get these normalization deals done?
Well, it's part of Trump's style of doing business, that he will blackmail, you know, pressure people, try to use whatever economic or political leverage he has to get what he wants, and he doesn't really care. And Trump, of course, is not a Democrat and doesn't care what the people think. He just looks at his own tiny, narrow perspective and how it might benefit him and some of his close friends. So Pakistan is a democracy, and you know, as the previous speaker said, you know, the Pakistani people are not in favor of abandoning the Palestinians because of the aforementioned points. The history is quite interesting, actually. And there was Pakistani troops in Jordan in 1970 when Black September, and the Pakistani troops under the command of I think it was a Colonel Zia at the time, later General Zia, and that was used to help put down a popular uprising against the king. And also there are at least two divisions in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, that are there to protect and support the Saudi royal family, and they give a lot of money to Pakistan for this. So, and in fact, it's also interesting that John Gunther Dean, who is the former American ambassador to India, said that Israel was involved with the assassination of General Zia because he was pursuing a nuclear arms program, because India has nuclear weapons, and that the plane was blown up. And I believe there's a couple American generals that were traveling with him at the time. And, you know, so this is all very damning. So that the Gulf feudal regimes, who are autocratic and dictatorial, see Pakistan as important because it's something that they can rely upon to keep themselves in power. It's also, of course, one of the largest Muslim countries in the world. And if they could bring Pakistan aside, then that would help put pressure on Indonesia and Malaysia and some other countries that are also democratic and have large Muslim populations and are overwhelmingly pro-Palestinian.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Mr. Zafar Bangesh and Mr. Edward Corrigan, both joining us out of Canada. And that's a wrap for this segment of News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Elsewhere, daily coronavirus deaths in Germany has hit a new record with 962 fatalities registered in the past 24 hours. The figure posted Wednesday brings total COVID deaths in Germany to nearly 28,000. December has been the deadliest month there since the pandemic began. The country registered at least 10,000 deaths in the first 3 weeks of December. That was nearly double November's fatality toll. The virus has surged despite a partial lockdown in place since early November. The country has now tightened that lockdown for a week and says it could remain in place until at least January the 10th. So far, more than 1.5 million people have been infected by COVID-19 in Germany. Scuffles have broken out between truck drivers and police in England's coastal town of Dover. The truck drivers demanded to cross to France. A group of them began booing police, and some started pushing officers to break through their lines. Several thousands of truck drivers, many from across Europe, have been stuck for days in southern England. That comes as the UK is struggling with a new COVID-19 variant proved to spread faster. UK and French governments have now reached a deal to reopen their border from Wednesday if the drivers test negative for COVID.
All flights and trains coming from the United Kingdom have been barred from entering Europe. Other countries, including Canada, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Morocco, have also suspended flights to and from the UK for 48 hours or more. Britons have been rattled by the Prime Minister's announcement that Christmas visits will have to be cancelled because of the new COVID-19 strain. And now there are growing fears the country will run out of fresh food in the days before Christmas because of freight and transport disruption. The government insists there's nothing to be worried about, though, and that ahead of Brexit, the government is fully prepared.
It's vital first to stress that these delays, which are only occurring at Dover, only affect human-handled freight, and that is only 20% of the total arriving from or departing to the European continent, which means the vast majority of food, medicines and other supplies are coming and going as normal.
The British government is dealing with an escalating public health crisis, deepening economic upheaval and Brexit trade talks in Brussels simultaneously. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's handling of all three crises has come under fire and faith in the government is waning.
It's just got to a point where now people are just going to feel like their freedom is being restricted and their basic sort of human rights, and it's spending millions of pounds on an app that doesn't even work. So, I mean, yeah, making promises they can't adhere to. So I think, yeah, they've really shot themselves in the foot.
They're doing an okay job. I think obviously they could probably do better. But, you know, I think it's always easy when you're looking on the outside in, going, you know, we'd do this or that.
No more promises that we'll be over this by such and such a day at a time now. I mean, it's a difficult situation for the government. But no more promises. We'll be over this by Christmas, Easter, a day at a time. It's debatable. Who would want to be in the government situation at the moment? It's changing by the day worldwide.
I think, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I would urge people to think about, you know, what would they have done if they'd have been faced with everything that has happened, because I don't necessarily think that there's one right course of action. I don't necessarily think that our government have handled it the perfect way, but what is the perfect way kind of thing? And I don't think people have helped themselves by rebelling against the rules and all of that kind of thing. So
people are going to complain no matter what Boris Johnson says or does. So
the new strain of COVID-19 has already been detected in the Netherlands, Denmark, Belgium and Iceland. On the upside, the scientists are saying the new strain is not resistant to the vaccines now being approved and administered. More than 500,000 people have received the Pfizer jab in the UK, which was the first country to approve it, and Europe's medicine regulators have approved it as well, which means inoculations will be underway across the bloc in a matter of days. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
When U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jay Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading Fewer Jobs and Rising Poverty. Scathing report finds Trump economic legacy one of the worst among all U.S. presidents. Stay tuned, please, for the details. When U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. And for that, a scathing new report by Democrats on the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, JEC, argues the outgoing president only has himself to blame. Released on Friday, December 18th, in response to the 2020 economic report of the president, the assessment of the Trump's economic performance during his 4 years in office runs directly counter to the rosy depiction frequently offered by the president himself, who seldom missed an opportunity to boast about the state of the stock market even in the midst of nationwide material suffering brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. American businesses and workers are struggling to survive because President Trump refused to listen to advice from public health experts and economists about the best way to handle the coronavirus. Representative Don Beyer, the incoming JEC chair, said in a statement, "In fact, his handling of the coronavirus will hurt the economy for years to come. That is President Trump's economic legacy, one of the worst among all U.S. presidents." The new report examines Trump's economic record dating back to the beginning of his administration, which began with soaring promises on jobs, trade, wages, health care, and other key policy matters. While Trump inherited a steadily improving economy, the president failed to pursue policies that would sustain and strengthen the economic expansion, the JEC report argues. As many analysts predicted before its passage and implementation, the $1.5 trillion tax cuts on jobs that Trump signed into law in December of 2017 delivered most of its benefits to the rich and failed to produce anything resembling an economic boom. President Trump's televised claim that the tax cuts would be one of the great Christmas gifts to the middle-income people proved to be deeply misleading, the JEC report notes. Analysis reveals that the tax cuts heavily favored the very wealthy, with the top 1% of households, those with average incomes of almost $2 million, projected to receive an average tax break of nearly $50,000 in 2020. This is approximately 64 times the average tax cut of the middle 20% of households, who were projected to receive an average tax cut of $780, the report continues. The poorest 20% were projected to receive an average tax cut of just $60. Trump's trade promises were similarly empty, the report finds. The president's oft-touted trade war with China resulted in hundreds of thousands of lost U.S. jobs. A study by Moody's Analytics found that by September 2019, it had cost the U.S. economy nearly 300,000 jobs, the JEC notes. While the president's economic performance prior to the coronavirus pandemic was far from successful, Trump's handling of the COVID-19 crisis and resulting economic collapse was catastrophic, pushing millions more into poverty and leaving countless Americans unable to afford basic necessities. At present, the U.S. has around 10 million fewer jobs than it did at the start of the pandemic. The JEC observes that after Congress and the White House approved the $2.2 trillion CARES Act in March, providing a temporary $600 per week boost to unemployment benefits and a round of one-time stimulus payments to many Americans, the administration and Senate Republicans refused to work to negotiate another package until a few weeks before the expiration of the unemployment supplement, a lapse that dramatically slashed the incomes of millions of people in the U.S. The administration's mismanagement of the coronavirus and its grudging response to limit the resulting economic damage have exposed and widened vast structural inequalities, the report states. Low-income workers and people of color have been most harmed by COVID-19 and the ensuing recession. They are more likely to be exposed to the virus, to be hospitalized, and to die from it. The JEC Democrats conclude that by all objective measures, job growth, unemployment, gross domestic product, Trump leaves the economy in much worse condition than he found it. However, the numbers do not tell the whole story. His failure to use the power of the presidency to fight the coronavirus will weigh down the U.S. economy for years to come, the report says. His successor will be left with an extraordinary challenge to reverse the failure of the Trump administration. He must also move beyond them to ensure that the United States builds back better from this crisis. fully utilizing the talents and resources of all these people to build an economy that is fairer, stronger, more inclusive, and more resilient.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam, Mir Baghiri, about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.
حالا ده ها از این آثار سنگینی که در زیارت سید شهدا آمده.
There are many fruitful outcomes for paying ziyara to the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Of course, the path of paying ziyara to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam might not be an easy one, and even sometimes it may be a dangerous one. However, if someone is really interested in taking steps on this path, he or she must bear its difficulties too. Even it is recommended not to leave this path, even if it is full of dangers, because some special rewards are considered for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
برای پیاده رفتن در این راه باز همینطور و
There are also some special rewards if you go on feet to visit the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This point is mentioned in many authentic narrations of the Shia infallible imams. There are both worldly and otherworldly rewards for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is as if all the heaven and earth are serving the pilgrims of the tombs of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and in fact paved the way for the visitors in Karbala.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of the short speech by Hojatul Islam Mir Baghiri. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Boris Johnson is facing intense pressure to impose another national lockdown within days, as more than 40 countries banned arrivals from the United Kingdom in an effort to keep out a new fast-spreading variant of coronavirus. Government scientific advisors warned that inaction could cost tens of thousands of lives and risk an economic, human, and social disaster, with a new strain spreading across the United Kingdom and overseas. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Peter Walker, Natalie Grover, Daniel Buffy, and Josh Halliday. The piece is titled, Calls for National Lockdown in England to Curb Spread of New COVID Strain. Boris Johnson is facing intense pressure to impose another national lockdown within days as more than 40 countries banned arrivals from the United Kingdom in an effort to keep out a new fast-spreading variant of coronavirus. Government scientific advisors warned that inaction could cost tens of thousands of lives and risk an economic, human, and social disaster, with the new strain spreading across the United Kingdom as well as overseas. Ministers urged people to avoid panic buying food as France failed to lift its ban on freight and passengers from the United Kingdom on Monday, despite a personal appeal from the Prime Minister, who asked Emmanuel Macron to put aside his anxiety over the new strain of COVID-19. Speaking at a Downing Street press conference, Boris Johnson strived to reassure other world leaders that Britain has responded swiftly. "I hope that everybody can see that as soon as we were briefed as a government of the fast transmissibility of this new strain, we launched all the necessary information with the World Health Organization, and we took prompt and decisive action the very next day to curb the spread of the variant within the United Kingdom," he said. Johnson said delays to cross-channel freight affected a small proportion of food entering the United Kingdom, as British supermarkets have said their supply chains are strong and robust, so everyone can continue to shop normally. Even so, some shoppers reported queues and empty shelves at various supermarkets. Downing Street insisted the measures imposed at the weekend, which placed London and areas in the south and east of England in a lockdown like Tier 4, but left people elsewhere still able to mix on Christmas Day, could control the spread of the new variant of COVID-19. The message from health officials and scientists was very different. In a joint statement, Greater Manchester's directors of public health said anyone arriving in the region from a Tier 4 area or from Wales, which is also in effect in lockdown, should self-isolate for at least 10 days. Cases of the COVID mutation, which is thought to spread between people with up to 70% greater efficiency, have been detected across the United Kingdom. And Boris Johnson's chief scientific advisor said stronger curbs were likely. Speaking at a Downing Street press conference, alongside the Prime Minister, Sir Patrick Vallance said the new strain was everywhere and cases would rise after inevitable mixing at Christmas. "The lesson I think you have to learn about this virus is that it's important to get ahead of it in terms of actions," Patrick Vallance said. "I think it is likely that this will grow in numbers of the variant across the country, and I think it's likely, therefore, that measures will need to be increased in some places in due course, not reduced." Since news emerged at the weekend about the rapid spread of the new variant across parts of England, at least 42 countries have banned all flights from the United Kingdom, or said that only their nationals may be allowed in following a negative coronavirus test. They include Belgium, Italy, Austria, Germany, Spain, Portugal, Bulgaria, Hungary, Luxembourg, Slovakia, Poland, Romania, Switzerland, South Africa, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Croatia, France, Malta, Sweden, Turkey, Hong Kong, Canada, India, Russia, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, Oman, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, El Salvador, Ireland, the Czech Republic, Colombia, Morocco, Chile, Finland, and Argentina. In a briefing on Monday, 21st of December, scientists said they had examined additional data and now had high confidence that the new strain had a transmission advantage over other virus variants circulating in the United Kingdom. "We still don't understand the exact biological mechanism," said Peter Hornby, professor of emerging infectious diseases at Oxford University, who chairs the government's new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group, or NERVTAG. "So so there's still a lot of uncertainty about exactly how it's occurring and exactly the extent of the extra transmissibility. Other scientists said the variant was unlikely to be largely contained to south and east of England, and noted that the United Kingdom was heading towards the first wave peak of hospital admissions and deaths to accompany the added toll of winter on the National Health Service. A further 33,364 people were reported to have tested positive UK-wide on Monday, 21st of December, and 215 people died. As Boris Johnson confirmed that more than 500,000 people had received the first dose of the only approved COVID vaccine, scientists said harsher measures now could save lives of those yet to be immunized. Andrew Hayward, a professor of infectious disease epidemiology at University College London and a member of the government's scientific advisory group for emergencies, or SAGE, said the new variant had the potential to spread around the UK as well as overseas. I recognize that we have restricted travel from tier 4 areas, but this transmission is not only in those tier 4 areas. It's there at some level across the country, he said. Andrew Hayward added, we're just entering a really critical phase of this pandemic, and it makes absolute sense to act decisively, I would say, across the country, as many other countries have done, despite them not, as far as we know, being affected by this strain. Asked if it would be advisable to have a national lockdown, Andrew Hayward said, personally, I think it's clearer to give a consistent national message, because although the level of risk are different in different parts of the country, they're still there and they're still substantial. Essentially, what we're really doing is very much trying to reduce transmission until we can protect as many of the vulnerable as possible. And that would buy us more weeks in which we could get people vaccinated. I couldn't give you a precise estimate, but my view is that it will be in the scale of tens of thousands of lives. An increase in transmissibility, even given exactly the same mortality rate per person, will lead to many, many more deaths unless one increases the effectiveness of our control measures. Robert West, Professor of Health Psychology at University College London's Institute of Epidemiology and Health, who sits on the Advisory Group on Behavioural Science for SAGE, said his personal opinion was that the current system was unlikely to contain the spread of the virus. He said, we need to reset our strategy and move rapidly to a zero COVID strategy of the kind that many have been proposing. This will involve stricter but more rational social distancing rules across the country. And finally, doing what we should have done from the start, to build the kind of test, travel, isolate and support programs they have in countries in the Far East. It sounds expensive, but the alternative could well be a catastrophic collapse in confidence in the country's ability to control the virus and the economic, human and social disaster that would follow. Asked why Tier 4 measures were not being pushed out across England, Boris Johnson's spokesman said, I would point to the fact that we've been clear that people shouldn't be travelling out of Tier 4 areas, and I would point to the changes that we have made in terms of Tier 4, he said. We're being clear that people should remain at home and limit human interaction. Asked whether the House of Commons could be recalled to allow any angry MPs to debate the new measures, the spokesman said this would only be done to ratify any Brexit deal. If we need to recall Parliament for the purpose of Brexit, we will.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Many times it has been mentioned, and I'm sure listeners have heard this many times before, that the human being has two dimensions of existence, one being his physical dimension, the other being his spiritual dimension. And in the tradition, this is also quite clear. And in the tradition we will share with you today, this duality or this dichotomy that we have amongst us is quite clear. We see that, yes, there are certain things we do that feeds our physical body. Obviously, we need food to eat, and eating nourishes our physical body. It gives us energy. It enables us to live. It enables us to survive. It enables our organs to work and to function properly. It also enables us to think. But there's also a second side, that the spiritual side, that soul, that ruh, that heart, if you want to call it as well, as we mentioned previously, it itself, and it also needs a type of food, a type of nourishment. And in this tradition of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, it's a very beautiful tradition, in that he says that, what is the food of that soul? How do you nourish your soul? The Imam is reported to have said that the nourishment of the body is food. It's quite obvious. As we mentioned, you need food to survive. The minerals and so on that the body needs to replenish is gained from food, obviously in its proportions. Whilst the nourishment of the soul, this is very beautiful, is feeding others. That if you give that food that you need for your own physical body. Obviously, if you have access of it, or if you just want to feed somebody you want to feed, whether you have a banquet even, the hadith is not clear. You invite people to your home, you feed a poor person, you have a meal with your family, and so on and so forth. You actually prepare something to give. You prepare or you provide funds for food to be distributed at the majalis, for example. Many different instances and reference can be found for this tradition. But all of them, if it's considered as feeding others, you're actually not feeding, you're only feeding their physical body. But at the same time as you're feeding and giving them the necessity of life, you're feeding your soul. And this is more important, that we know that our physical bodies will wear down, will eventually, you know, disappear to a certain extent. But our soul will remain, our soul will be that which on the day of judgment will be judged. And that much of food that we have given will be something that will assist us and enable us on the day of judgment to stand with our hands up high and say, look, alhamdulillah, I actually did something good for my soul. I did not just feed my stomach, but I fed the stomach of others. And by doing so, my spiritual body gained weight, if you like to call it that. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to feed our soul just as we feed our body. And just as we take importance in feeding our body, we take the same importance in feeding our soul. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.